It's nearly 12 o'clock and time for the KMXT Midday Report. Thank you for listening to KMXT. On 100.1 FM, it is your public radio station. We're broadcasting from up here on Signal Hill in beautiful downtown Kodiak, where it is presently 54 degrees. We're looking at sort of a fog mist. 89% humidity at the airport right now with east winds to 12 and 5 miles of visibility. Rain is likely today, at least until 1 p.m., mostly cloudy skies for the rest of the day and tonight and tomorrow. High near 56 today, low of 48 tonight, high of 55 tomorrow. Southeast winds are expected to go to 15 today, coming down to 5 tonight, turning to the south tomorrow to 10. Coming up on the Midday Report, the city of Kodiak proclaims LGBTQIA+ Pride Month, and the assembly follows suit. Residents of the Lower Yukon who fled to Bethel are beginning to return home.
Live from NPR News, I'm Lakshmi Singh. Georgia's leading election officials plan to testify before Congress next week about the pressure they resisted from former President Donald Trump and his allies to overturn President Biden's victory in Georgia in 2020. Sources tell NPR a House Select Committee slated to hear Tuesday from Georgia's Secretary of State Brad Raffensperger and his COO Gabriel Sterling. Meanwhile, NPR's Kerry Johnson reports former Trump White House trade advisor Peter Navarro has pleaded not guilty to criminal contempt charges for failing to fully cooperate with the committee's probe into last year's riot at the U.S. Capitol.
Peter Navarro initially tried to represent himself in the criminal case, brushing aside guidance from a magistrate judge. But this week, he hired former federal prosecutors to help him fight the contempt charges. Attorney John Rowley told reporters they intend to put on an aggressive defense. Navarro refused to cooperate with the House Select Committee investigating the attack on the Capitol, saying the panel needed to negotiate with former President Donald Trump. Prosecutors say the case is not that complex. Judge Amit Mehta has set the trial for November 17th, after the House panel is expected to release its report and after the midterm elections. Kerry Johnson, NPR News, Washington.
Police say a third victim has died following last night's shooting at a church potluck outside Birmingham, Alabama. Miranda Fulmore of member station WBHM has more.
The shooting happened just before sundown at St. Stephen's Episcopal Church in Vestavia Hills. Police Captain Shane Ware identified the suspect as a 71-year-old white male who occasionally attended the church. They haven't released a motive, but said he used a handgun. Ware says another church attendee held the man down until police arrived.
It was extremely critical in saving lives. The person that subdued the suspect, in my opinion, is a hero.
Two of the victims have been identified as 75-year-old Sarah Yeager and 84-year-old Walter Rainey. An 84-year-old woman also died, but police aren't releasing her identity at her family's request. For NPR News, I'm Miranda Fulmore in Vestavia Hills, Alabama.
Ukraine says it's documented more than 15,000 possible war crimes by invading Russian forces. NPR's Greg Myrie reports on some of what the new U.S. ambassador sees so far.
Ambassador Bridget Brink, who arrived in Ukraine less than 3 weeks ago, has already visited several suburbs of the capital, Kyiv, where the Russians have been accused of widespread abuses.
This is a really important priority, and it's why I wanted to personally go to some of these sites really early on upon my arrival.
She received a tour from Ukraine's top prosecutor, who is pursuing cases even as the war carries on. The ambassador said the U.S. is providing funding to help the Ukrainians gather and analyze evidence. Three Russian soldiers have already been tried and convicted. Greg Myrie, NPR News, Kyiv.
This is NPR.
NPR News is presentada a usted en parte por la Providence Kodiak Island Centro de Asesoramiento. Para una cita o más información, por favor llama al 907-481-2400.
For KMXT, I'm Terry Haynes. The city of Kodiak proclaimed June as LGBTQIA+ Pride Month at its last council meeting, and the Kodiak Island Borough issued its own proclamation at last night's assembly meeting. KMXT's Kirsten Dobroth reports the support comes on the tailwinds of a month-long lineup of Pride events in Kodiak.
Kodiak's June Pride celebration started as a virtual walk and run back in 2020 to raise money for the Trevor Project. That grew into an in-person rainbow run, followed by a post-race party last year. And this year, it's even bigger and encompasses a month of Pride events, like LGBTQ+ trivia night, glow yoga, and even a float in Kodiak's Crab Festival parade.
It's been really neat to see the community embrace it.
Monica Claridge is one of the organizers of Kodiak Pride, which is the group behind the events. Claridge says local businesses and nonprofits have partnered with Kodiak Pride for the month-long lineup of festivities, and they're hoping to use the momentum to roll out more community programming.
We have a Pride committee that's been working on a bunch of different ideas to have more events and raise more awareness and eventually get stuff going year-round.
Pride Month is celebrated across the country each June to commemorate the 1969 Stonewall riots in New York City, which marked a turning point for LGBTQ rights. But it hasn't always been forward progress, and Claridge says local support makes a big difference.
It's really an important time for us to make sure that, you know, we're taking the steps that we can to help make sure that this is a safe and inclusive place for everyone.
A full schedule of this month's events is available on the Kodiak Pride Facebook page. In Kodiak, I'm Kirsten Dobrath.
People who fled to Bethel to escape the historic tundra fires along the lower Yukon River have started to return home after a week in Bethel. The fire growth has shifted away from the village. But as Alaska Public Media's Lex Trinan reports, returning residents still face a lot of uncertainty, both short-term and long-term.
At the airline terminal for Ute commuter services in Bethel, a man plays the harmonica as two kids dance nearby. There's about 20 people waiting. Children squirm in their chairs or spin basketballs, while some of the grown-ups talk on their phones. They're waiting for their names to be called for a seat on a flight back to their homes in St. Mary's, a community of about 600 people on the Yukon River.
St. Mary's, Kara and Cornelius.
Elder Sebastian Cowboy is one of the people waiting. He's thankful the town of Bethel took the evacuees in. About 100 people stayed at the two shelters in town after they evacuated due to smoke from a massive tundra fire that burned to within a few miles of the community. The Yukon-Kuskokwim Health Corporation says there is still a risk of smoke or fire in St. Mary's, and it doesn't have the resources to pay for another flight out should conditions get worse. But Cowboy says he's ready to go home. The thing he misses most?
My own pillow.
Cowboy says he'll get to work on some house projects and chop wood for the winter. Like many other St. Mary's residents, he's feeling a lot of uncertainty about the future. There's the short-term risk of winds shifting smoke back towards the village, but there's also the long-term risks of a warming climate that scientists say is contributing to the unprecedented fires in the region that have so far burned up hundreds of thousands of acres. It's not just the elders who are noticing the changes. Teenager Carmen Tinker says she's noticing things too.
Getting windier in the spring. My yearbook teacher said that it used to never be windy in the spring. It got more windy.
Some residents say the north winds that pushed the fire towards their community was unusual for the village that's often cooled by the coastal western breeze. Maureen Andrews, who's stayed at a Bethel shelter with three kids, says a warmer climate means the vegetation around St. Mary's is changing too.
The trees around my home, I notice they have gotten thicker every year.
Those bigger trees mean more fuel for fires to burn. Aside from the health effects of the smoke, some residents are concerned about changes to their food security. Last year, salmon fishing remained closed and has stayed closed through this summer. Evacuating for fires now means less time for other subsistence work, and the fire itself disrupts harvesting, says Roseanne Joe.
It's burning all of our berry spots. I don't know what we're going to do for berries this year. Jeez, no fish, no berries.
Joe says most years she goes up in the hills of the area that's now burning. She says she picks 15 gallons of salmon berries, known in other parts of the state as cloudberries, and 25 gallons of blueberries each year.
Scary to be thinking what my kids are going to grow up to see.
For now, residents of the region say they're taking each day as it comes. There's no playbook for how to adapt to the changing climate. It means that everyone's deciding for themselves whether to stay in Bethel until the fires die down completely or to return home, where the smoke could thicken at any moment. For George Moses, his damaged lungs mean he'll stay in Bethel till it's all cleared.
I gotta wait till it's kinda smoke-free.
Nobody really knows how long it might take for that air to clear. Reporting with help from KYUK's Olivia Eberts in Bethel, I'm Lex Trinan.
The Iowithla River fire has grown to 27,500 acres and is about 9 miles from Dillingham. According to the State Division of Forestry, 6 Fire Boss planes were dispatched to help control the fire spread westward, scooping water from the Wood River and dousing the flames. Another plane was dispatched to run an aerial air traffic control. Public Information Officer Brentwood Reed says the division's goal is to keep the southern and western fronts contained within natural barriers, such as creeks and rivers.
Those aircraft, primarily their focus was to reinforce the natural barrier, that creek on the west side that it seems to be holding up on.
Planes were unable to drop water on the northwest corner of the fire due to excessive smoke. Reed says the Kokwak River fire, which has burned over 22,000 acres, has calmed down as well.
The Kokwak fire, which is north, is showing just a little bit of heat today on the very far northwest, or very northern perimeter, very minimal though.
On the east side of the region, the Pauls Creek and Contact Creek fires have been reduced to smolders. They have burned at least 10,000 acres each. Reed says the Division of Forestry will continue to survey the area for hotspots.
We are monitoring that with aerial infrared satellites. And then, of course, we've got the fire bosses down there in King Salmon and helicopters in King Salmon that are working on the Fire 239 that fly through that area regularly. And so right now it's not showing any heat on the infrared.
Smoke from nearby blazes may cause breathing problems, and the Dillingham Fire Department has recommended sensitive or compromised individuals wear N95 masks until air quality improves. Cool weather and rain is forecasted for Bristol Bay this weekend. A burn ban is still in effect in Dillingham. Candidates for the U.S. House who did poorly in Saturday's special primary are reevaluating whether they want to run in the regular election for the next 2-year term of Congress. Democrat Chris Constant is out of both. Now that there's a top four in the special primary, Constant says attention will focus on those candidates as they simultaneously campaign for the special general and regular primary.
The financial interests are going to support one of those, and I think I need to be behind the one who most closely represents my values.
Constant is endorsing Democrat Mary Peltola, who remains in the top four so far. Constant finished in eighth place, according to the latest ballot count. Fifth place finisher Tara Sweeney issued a statement conceding she's out of the special and would meet with her campaign team and supporters to consider her next steps in the regular. Nonpartisan Jeff Lowenfels finished seventh in the special. He says he's not looking forward to another crowded primary, but he's not ready to make a decision.
I can't imagine that it wouldn't be a repeat of what we've got here with 20, 30 people running, which once again sets up an opportunity where there are no issues that one can debate, where there are no forums. That does not sound like something I want to participate in.
The deadline to drop out of the regular primary is June 25th. 31 candidates are running in that race. Election day is August 16th. On that day, voters will also decide who wins the special general to serve the remaining months of the year in the U.S. House. Some Alaska lawmakers are raising red flags about the number of ballots rejected in the special U.S. House primary. Ballots are still being tallied, but so far, about 4% of the roughly 155,000 ballots received statewide have been rejected. As Alaska Public Media's Wesley Early reports, that percentage is much higher in rural Alaska communities.
Alaska just held its first statewide mail-in election. In the crowded primary to fill the rest of Congressman Don Young's term, the top four vote-getters are Sarah Palin, Nick Begich, Al Gross, and Mary Peltola. But Anchorage Senator Bill Willikowski says as votes were tallied in recent days, he was more struck by the number of ballots the state rejected.
These huge numbers of rejected ballots are occurring predominantly in rural Alaska, huge native populations, and in low-income areas of Alaska.
About 6,200 ballots have been rejected so far by the Division of Elections, coming at just under 4% of all ballots. That's double the rejection rate from the 2020 primary. In the most recent results, the rejection percentage varies starkly by region. In areas near Bethel, it's the highest at around 17%. That means about one in every six ballots were rejected and the votes not counted. The rejection rate is above 10% in the Kotzebue and Utqiagvik area, as well as around Nome and Bristol Bay. Along with five other Alaska Senate Democrats, Willikowski sent a letter to Division of Elections officials on Tuesday asking for an explanation for what they described as a, quote, breakdown of our election system and the democratic process for those citizens whose votes were not counted.
It's really imperative for Division of Elections to get a handle on this, figure out what the problem is, and either figure out a way to educate the voters or remove these unnecessary bureaucratic barriers that are being placed that are making it difficult for low-income and Native voters to vote.
Division of Elections officials say they'll have data on why the ballots were rejected after the election is certified on June 25th. They declined to comment on the senator's letter. Willikowski says he hasn't gotten answers yet from the division either, but he thinks the issue is likely the witness signature requirement on the ballots. The requirement was in place for the 2020 statewide election for absentee ballots, but a Superior Court ruled that was unconstitutional. Willikowski describes the witness signature requirement for this election as a, quote, bureaucratic roadblock.
You have a signature requirement, but the Division of Elections has no way to verify the signatures. Then you have a witness requirement, but the Division of Elections doesn't verify the signatures of the witness and doesn't even verify that the witness lives in Alaska or is even a living person.
Willikowski says one potential solution to this problem is through a process called ballot curing. In 24 states, officials will notify residents if there's an issue with their ballot and allow them to make any needed changes before counting it. Currently in Alaska, the state will notify somebody by mail if their ballot is rejected 10 days after the election is certified.
That's something I think the Division of Elections needs to look into. I know in the legislature we had legislation to allow ballot cure. Unfortunately, it didn't pass. But I'm curious if the Division of Elections has the emergency regulatory authority to just enact that on its own. We're talking about a fundamental right. One of the most fundamental rights that any person has in a democracy is the right to vote.
Historically, elections in Alaska can be close, with Representative Bryce Edgman's election in 2006 being decided by a coin toss, and Representative Bart Laban winning his election by one vote in 2018, a matter that reached the Alaska Supreme Court. Willikowski says that history also underscores the need to ensure that every Alaska ballot is counted. With three more statewide elections set to happen this year, Willikowski says if the Division of Elections can't address the issue, a special session of the legislature may be required. In Anchorage, I'm Wesley Early.
Ketchikan City Council voted 5-2 on Thursday to allow a drag queen story reading at the public library to proceed as planned. KRBD's Eric Stone reports.
A drag queen is scheduled to read a book called The Hips on the Drag Queen Go Swish, Swish, Swish at the event celebrating Pride Month at the city-run library. A children's librarian is scheduled to read several other books at the event as well. It's been the subject of significant controversy. Ketchikan City Council member Riley Gass asked the council at two separate meetings to cancel the event, including on Thursday.
Why do some feel the need to push this sexualized, unnatural ideology onto children at such a young age? And why is this being pushed to take place in the city-owned library?
Dozens of people turned out to discuss Gass's proposal on Thursday, with some attendees spilling into the hallway outside the council chambers. Testimony on the issue was split nearly evenly. Like Gass, many of the opponents of the story time said they were concerned the event could harm children. Resident Tamila Sajelski was among those who asked the council to cancel the story time during public comment.
I think this drag queen story hour is really inappropriate. It sexualizes children. I think it grooms children and indoctrinates children.
That argument, though, didn't hold much water with many on the council, including Judy Zinge.
If you're that worried that seeing a bit of glitter is going to change your child sexually, then yes, you should probably stay home. You probably shouldn't take your child there. I'm not going to support this because I think it's very discriminatory. And I really am embarrassed to be sitting here knowing that we have to deal with this.
Resident Ryan McHale also pushed back on the idea that the drag queen event could be harmful to kids during public comment. He said much of the criticism played on homophobic tropes.
Anti-LGBTQ+ discourse is often framed around the vulnerability of children. There have been accusations of child grooming, indoctrination, manipulation, pedophilia, attempting to sexualize children, and promote sexualized content with no factual basis beyond ingrained prejudice, shielded behind a vague reference to safeguarding children.
Councilmember Jana Lee Gage, for her part, said canceling the event would violate city code.
Removing this drag queen event at the library would be a direct violation of the Ketchikan anti-discrimination ordinance and a civil rights violation.
Ketchikan's city attorney went further in a memo to the council prior to the meeting. He suggested canceling the event could violate the state's civil rights law and the First Amendment, in addition to the city ordinance. The final vote was 5-2, with votes from Gass and Councilmember Jay Mitani in favor of canceling the event. Like Gass, Mitani said he was concerned the event could harm children.
So I'd like to err on the side of caution here.
Though the story time will proceed as planned, the fight on the issue doesn't appear to be over. Ketchikan's Borough Assembly will consider Monday whether to place a question on the October municipal ballot that would eliminate borough funding to the library because of the drag queen story time controversy. Reporting in Ketchikan, I'm Eric Stone.
Insight Daily Radio. Iconic guitarist Eric Clapton's lifelong passion for the blues burns brightly in a new film and soundtrack release entitled Nothing But the Blues. The documentary film, which was nominated for an Emmy Award but was broadcast only once in the U.S. in 1995, has been upgraded to 4K for its long-awaited official Blu-ray and DVD release. The new soundtrack album features all of the music from the 1995 film, and also includes more than an hour of previously unreleased live performances recorded in 1994 during the legendary guitarist tour supporting From the Cradle, his Grammy-winning multi-platinum blues album. Eric spoke about his lifelong love and respect for the blues and its impact on his playing.
I have tried to play folk music, play country and western, play even jazz, and a lot of pop music, but I do this best. And that's been given to me to do. And as much as I've questioned it and railed against it and been stubborn about my path, I'm back on it. But this is me in terms of my musical identity today, where I've come from and what I mean. And wherever I go in the future will be as a result of this.
That's iconic guitarist Eric Clapton, whose long-awaited documentary film and music soundtrack, Nothing But the Blues, will be released on multiple formats on June 24th. There's more at ericclapton.com. Insight Daily Radio.
This is the Island Messenger, a look at personal messages, the weather, and community announcements.
Good afternoon and welcome to your Island Messenger for Friday. It is the 17th day of June, the year 2022. The sun rose today at 5:07. It will set again at 11:13. That will give us 18 hours and 6 minutes of daylight, a gain of 35 seconds compared to yesterday. A record low for this date was 36, set in 1966 and 1975, and our record high was 80 degrees, set in 2015. Looking at our local tides, we have a high tide coming up at 5:51 this afternoon of 7.3 feet. That will be followed by a low tide at 10:59, call it 11 p.m., of 2.3 feet here on the east side. Over on the west side, your high tide will happen at 6:07 this evening and be 12.7 feet. Your next low tide will be at 11:47 this evening and be 3.6 feet. In Larson Bay. Let's hear what the Alaska Department of Fish and Game has to say.
Hello, this is the Alaska Department of Fish and Game in Kodiak with revised Kodiak Commercial Salmon Fishery Advisory Announcement Number 5, date issued 2 p.m. on June 15th. There will be a 57-hour commercial salmon fishing period in the Outer Karlik section of the Southwest Kodiak District from noon Thursday, June 16th, until 9 p.m. Saturday, June 18th. There will be a 48-hour extension to the current commercial salmon fishing period from 9 p.m. Thursday, June 16th, until 9 p.m. Saturday, June 18th, in the following areas: in the central and north cape sections of the northwest Kodiak District, the southwest Afognak section of the Afognak District, the Outer Aikulik section of the southwest Kodiak District, and the Cape Alitak, Humpy Deadman, Alitak Bay, Mosier Bay, and Olga Bay sections of the Alitak District. The following areas will close to commercial salmon fishing at 9 p.m. Wednesday, June 15th. The Anton Larsen Bay, Sheratine Bay, Kajuyak Bay, Terror Bay, Inner Euganic Bay, Spearden Bay, Zacher Bay, and Uyak Bay sections of the Northwest Kodiak District. The Northwest Afognak, Paul's Bay, and Paranosa Bay sections of the Afognak District, and the Eastside Kodiak District, and the Big River and Outer Kukak Bay sections of the Mainland District. Closed waters will be reduced until 9 p.m. Wednesday, June 15th, in the following areas: at Kaflia Creek, stream number 262301, to the stream terminus, and at Saltry Creek, stream number 259415, to the stream terminus. As previously announced, the following areas remain open to commercial salmon fishing until further notice: the Inner Katoy Bay, Outer Katoy Bay, Duck Bay, and Iziut Bay sections of the Afognak District, Fowl Bay Special Harvest Area, and Waterfall Bay Special Harvest Area. Fishermen are reminded that in the Kodiak area, including the Mainland District, until further notice, king salmon 28 inches or greater in length may not be retained by purse-seine gear in the commercial fishery and must be returned to the water unharmed. Closed waters are reduced in the following locations until further notice: in Fowl Bay to the stream terminus at Hidden Lake Creek, stream number 251406. In Waterfall Bay to the stream terminus at Little Waterfall Creek, stream number 251822. And to the stream terminus at Big Waterfall Creek, stream number 251821. And in Katoy Bay to the fishing game markers located in Little Katoy and Big Katoy Bays near stream numbers 252323 and 252324. Other closed waters are shown in the Kodiak Area Salmon Statistical Chart and detailed in Commercial Salmon Fishing Regulations and Statistical Charts, Harvest Strategies, and Commercial Salmon Fishing Regulations are available at the Kodiak Fish and Game Office. And, of course, the most recent salmon fisher information may be obtained by calling the department's 24-hour record phone at 486-4559. Thank you very much. Good luck fishing. This is the Alaska Department of Fish and Game.
Mariners, here is your forecast for Marmot Island to Sitkin at Kodiak's east side. Small craft advisory through tonight. Southeast 25, seas to 9 feet today. For tomorrow, south winds to 15, seas to 7 feet. Over in the Shelikof Strait, variable less than 10, becoming northeast 10 this afternoon, seas to 3 feet. For tomorrow, south winds to 15 knots, seas to 2 feet. Well, tonight's the night for the LGBTQ plus trivia night. That's going on at the Kodiak Island Brewery starting at 8 p.m. It's sponsored by Million Recipes, and a $5 cover charge includes two drink tokens. It's to raise awareness about LGBTQ history, terminology, current events, sports, science, you name it. It will begin with a brief talk about the Sukpiak traditions around gender, sexuality, and spirituality. You can find out more at the Kodiak Pride Facebook page. But again, that starts tonight at 8 Kodiak Island Brewery.
Hello, Kodiak, and welcome to the June 17th edition of Island Byways. I'm Pam Foreman. Green, green, green. The green seemed a long time coming this spring, but it sure has been coming on strong the past 3 weeks or so. You can watch the hillsides and mountainsides gaining green every day. It really is an amazing thing to see. Grasses will soon be over our heads, pushkie is well on its way, and the wildflower meadows are resplendent. Seems like every time of year on Kodiak is my favorite, but this time is really pretty special. All sorts of new things showing up, birds trying out their songs or wings for the first time, young bears learning what grasses to eat and the best places to dig for goodies in the sand. And then there's this. I love that sound. It's the raucous sound of baby ravens in the spruce forest. First, they start calling mom and dad back to the nest. Then the party really gets going when they fledge in a week or two. Mostly they just shout, "Hey, I'm lost. Where's the nest?" for a while. Soon the young ones will be practicing all the wonderful vocalizations ravens have, and it's as entertaining as listening to a puppy learn how to howl. Stop the next time you're in the forest and take a listen. Next week is my 33rd anniversary of arriving on Kodiak on a beautiful bluebird day. After enjoying the jaw-dropping views on the flight in, I marveled at the number and the size of the trees and the green everywhere. What a wonderful sight it was, and it still is. I count my lucky stars every day. Kodiak is a spectacular place to live and a wonderful place to get outside. And that's it for Island Byways this week. Have fun and stay safe out there. Thanks for listening.
Listen for the Island Messenger here on Public Radio KMXT three times a day, Monday through Friday at 9 a.m., during the Midday Report at 12:20, and in the evening at 7 o'clock. If you have a community announcement or personal message, including lost and found items or pets, you can call KMXT at 486-3181, fax us at 486-2733, or email psa@kmxt.org.